the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Happy New Year, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to our first show of Lifetime Income for 2016.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest today on the program is Wade Fow. He'll be discussing the new rules after major changes in Social Security. Some of the old tactics and techniques still apply. Well, here we are. We've passed the new year. New Year is always a time of new beginnings, a time when we make our New Year's resolutions. A week later, we break them. But besides that, we think about either making changes to our life, all for the better, improving our lives, making mid-course corrections, or wondering why we're here in the first place. But I would recommend you contact your priest, pastor, rabbi, or imam for that particular aspect of your life. But when we talk about financial planning, this is the time you need to think about it and make some mid-course changes to improve or do something different than what you've done in the past. It's an annual tradition, and sometimes it sticks. You know, actually, it goes far back to the ancient world if you look at it. The concept, regardless of particular creed you might follow, is to reflect upon self-improvement annually. Everything from improving your physical well-being, mental well-being, finances, education, quality goals, actually jettisoning bad things of the past and saying, well, we've turned a new page here, so whatever went wrong last year, this is a new year. So all of these philosophical considerations aside, this is a financial show, so we're going to focus on improving one's financial well-being. And whether you're just starting out, nearing retirement, or actually retired, what can you do this year to actually improve your financial situation? And in keeping with this tradition, this show is going to be about getting yourself into financial shape. Hopefully 2016 is the year that makes a major difference in your life.
You know, it is the beginning of the year, John. We always make those New Year's resolutions, and the experts will tell you it takes about 21 days of consistency to do something to make it a habit. I know, for example, in my own case, I always exercised and I made it a habit, but never got into that ideal weight. So one year, I made a resolution. I was going to actually begin to lose weight. So I did a lot of research, some would say, and an unrealistic goal. I wanted to basically shed about 20 pounds and get back to where I was when I was 50 years old. But I began doing research on diets, found many diets didn't work, and then I didn't want to get into, you've seen them, John, you measure your food, you count your calories, or you're counting your meals. I looked at everything from vegetarian to vegan to Mediterranean, and I finally settled on the paleo diet. It was one of the things that worked for me. In fact, there were two books that we interviewed both authors on the program, Amy Grant and Sarah Ballantyne, both are doctors, writing extensive books on the paleo diet that had a major influence, at least on something with my own struggles. And I finally had a breakthrough. And as a heads up, we have a number of great, great shows coming up this year on how to stay healthy physically as well as mentally, in addition to the financial issues that we'll be discussing, beginning with today's show.
Yeah, I gave up on mental health at one point in my career. At one point in my career, I reckoned I was mentally ill, and then I went into radio and made a career out of it, and it worked, you know. So, well, I'm going to keep on that losing weight track. I've been on it, and I'm going to stay on it right now, using a lot of the combined paleo and the alkaline diets. I've sort of done a combination diet, and it seems to work. But let's talk about getting into financial shape this year. Most of our programs here, we talk about the importance of planning. So let's revisit the issue, perhaps motivate our listeners to take those extra steps when you have a few minutes to formulate a financial plan that will help you navigate these financial markets. And given what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, you really do need a plan, because you need to add security to your lives, the plan that helps you achieve your financial goals and buffer whatever storms may come as a result of that. Why this is important and why the extra effort expended later on turns out to be well worth it.
You know, John, I can think of probably no other time, probably in my 35 years in the business, as what we have today of why having a plan has become this important. I mean, if you look at where we are today, people are living longer, which presents its own set of problems. We're also living in an era and will be, at least in my opinion, for an extended period of time of low interest rates. And then finally, I think the government is making dramatic changes to entitlements. I don't care if you're looking at Social Security or to Medicare. We've seen major changes. We talked about some of those last year that they made to Social Security, and I'll be taking that up with our expert on today's program with Dr. Wade Fow. So retirement needs to be rethought, and you better have a plan if you want to navigate your retirement successfully. I mean, let's face it. The old rules no longer apply. We live in a much, much different world today, and listeners need to adapt.
Yeah, and what would you say, you know, we look backwards at the good old days and say, ah, if it could only be the way when we had secure things. But what do you say is driving all the changes today? And there is no let up in that in the near future, let's face it.
Well, I mean, there's probably three big things that you'll hear people comment, but I would say these three collectively make up the major reason why retirement has changed. Number one, we're living longer. When Social Security went into effect in 1933, when they started it, the average life expectancy was about 65 years old for a male. Today, it's probably closer to 85. So we're living longer, which means we're spending a larger part of our adult life in retirement, which means we need to have the assets to carry us through that period of time. And secondly, we're in a low interest rate environment. I mean, I don't think anybody 10, 15 years ago, and I know at least when I started in this business around 1980, that was a period of time when you were getting 15% on government bonds, you were getting 12, 13% at the bank. Gosh, I can remember Ginnie Mae's were paying 13, 14%. Anywhere you looked, you could get a high rate of return. We've been in this low interest rate environment for 7 years, and it's not just this environment here in the United States, it's global. I mean, you think things are bad here, it's actually worse in Europe. They charge you to keep your money on deposit. If you go into government bonds, a good third of bonds in Europe, 7 years and under in terms of maturity, actually have negative yields. Imagine buying a bond and paying the government interest instead of them paying you interest. So the second thing is we're in a low interest rate environment. And third is the heavy entitlement burdens that are being placed on government. We talked extensively last year with some of the most significant changes made to Social Security in 3 decades were made in the month of November, reducing benefits all across the board on many strategies that have been used to take care of women as survivors. And then also take a look at all the changes that came about with, let's say, Obamacare, and before that with President Bush, where he actually doubled and tripled the Medicare premiums based on your income. Before, there was one premium rate for Medicare. Now there could be almost two or three, depending on the level of income. So the fact that we're living longer means our capital has to last us for a longer period of time. And most financial plans I see fail to account for this. The biggest expenses that you're going to face in retirement will occur in your latter years. If you have no inflation protection or long-term care insurance, John, in many cases, you could end up broke, or basically your kids have to take care of you. And the second factor, I think, is I think people will relate to this. We live in a much, much different investment environment today. Asset returns are much lower and are going to remain that way for a long period of time. In fact, the period of double-digit asset returns, everybody remembers the 90s when, heck, all you had to do was go into a stock fund. You made a double digits every single year. That's over. We had a few years like that between 2012 and 2014, but they won't be every year, and we are more likely to be punctuated by years of negative returns. A good example was 2015, where the major indexes were down slightly with the exception of the NASDAQ. So the era of double-digit returns on safe investments, as we saw in the 80s, is over, and John, unlikely to return for a long period of time. I don't think we'll see that again in our lifetime.
No, probably not. And you know, the third reason that you were talking about are government entitlement burdens. Now, that's a corner that the government has backed itself into, but it's real. I mean, it's something we've talked about here on the program. and on the main weekend show for quite some time. I remember we did a number of programs last year on the sweeping changes to Social Security. And of course, it's such a political football that a lot of times they don't really want you to know what's going on. I mean, there were changes that were passed in November in the budget bill. The media was silent on the issue as to what this really means. And you're going to be discussing that, as a matter of fact, today with our expert Wade Fow on retirement planning after these changes. Now, we know that under Bush and then under President Obama, sweeping changes have been made to Medicare. Costs have gone up based on your income. Coverage has been reduced and costs are going to be up even more in the future as greater government involvement in healthcare is driving up costs. And not only that, the burden on government goes up too. So the tendency of government is going to be to start reneging on the promises it's made to people. So it's a fact that we're living longer, that medical expenses are becoming a bigger issue in retirement budgets, and for individuals should be prepared to handle them when and if they occur. So let's talk about a retirement plan. What's involved? A lot of this is review from some of the things we went over in 2015, what kind of effort it takes and what makes it worthwhile. So take us through the steps in the process and what we can expect to see as an outcome.
Well, I mean, there are basically six steps that are involved in developing a retirement plan, and each step is important and builds on the one that precedes it. I mean, step one is really you have to decide if you're going to do a retirement plan, are you going to do it yourself, you can do your own research, or are you going to find a professional? And if you're looking for a professional, it's really finding somebody that you can relate to, somebody that has the expertise that you have confidence in, and it's really defining the relationship you're going to have with that planner. What do you expect from him or her? What do you expect out of the plan? What do you want to achieve? And basically, it is establishing that relationship. It's no different than if you were, let's say, moving to a new area or you were trying to find yourself a new family doctor. The second step is basically gathering as much information as you can and defining your goals and making sure the goals are sort of realistic. This is where a good planner can aid you in saying, look, you know, that's a great goal, but given our resources or our level of income, you know, that's not going to be possible at this time. It might be possible if we alter a few things. So gathering the data, defining the goals. Step three is then analyze and evaluate your financial situation. All right, this is where you are today. This is where you want to be. This is when you want to retire. This is the level of income. And basically, it's defining what you want to accomplish. And so that's step three. Step four is, all right, given our goals, given the resources that we have to work with, what are the solutions and what are some of the alternatives to help achieve those goals? Step five is basically implementing the plan. It may be seeing an estate planning attorney to draw up a will or trust or a special needs trust. It may be changing the investment portfolio. It may be tax planning. It may be tax advantage investments. Maybe you need to do things like tax-free bonds or tax deferral through some kind of pension plan. Or it may be, for example, some of the things that we'll be talking about with my guest today, Dr. Wade Fow, on Social Security. When should you take it? Should you take it at age 62? Or are you still better off waiting to age 70 and allow it to accumulate at 8% a year, given where your circumstances are? So you have to implement the recommendations of the plan. And then step six, monitor the plan and take corrective action, because your needs may change. We may get new tax legislation. The government may pass laws, as they did in November, making major sweeping changes to Social Security. The financial markets could change, or even your own health. So it's not just enough to have a plan, and that plan should take into consideration all aspects and all phases of your retirement, not just when you retire, your middle retirement years and your latter years, when you're more likely to run into more medical expenses that you're going to have to deal with.
Well, Jim, I take it that this is an involved process. I mean, it's also an ongoing plan. So what you do with the first part of the process is you lay the framework and you know what your plan is. But then your plan You know, I always remember, was it Bruce Lee said, everybody's got a plan and then somebody throws a punch. And what that means after that is what plan you just had just went to heck in a handbasket and you have to revise the plan. So your plan for retirement is to be able to deal with it when somebody throws an economic punch at you. It's an ongoing thing that you have to change. It's not a one and done type of thing or some formula that remains static. So, you know, as a matter of fact, if you think about it, I mean, just look at the world we live in today and then compare that to the world that existed, go back 15, 16 years to 2000. Many of the issues we discuss here on the program did not even exist back then. Even life expectancy has increased up 13 years or something like that. You know, the bear market, we have bear market in stocks where it was before we had certain things were bullish. Things have flipped over. Interest rates went to zero. They've remained there for 7 years, although they have squeaked up 0.25%, but effectively it hasn't changed very much. It's likely to remain low for the balance of the decade. And on top of that, the government has made sweeping changes to Social Security and Medicare. So having a plan and understanding what's happening is really important.
Yeah, and just as there have been sweeping changes in longevity, I mean, the good news, and, you know, the financial markets have responded. And same thing with the government. There's been a multitude of changes, John, in the financial world. We have so many more options that we can use today to help an individual or a couple achieve their financial goals. I don't care if it's investment strategies, tax planning, to, let's say, work options, to even looking at government entitlement options differently. I mean, there's many things you can do with your Social Security benefits, which we spent a lot of time talking about last year, and we're going to be spending some time talking about that this year. We'll start today with Dr. Wade Fowle, because in many cases, depending on your income and circumstances, it still may make sense to delay taking your Social Security, assuming you're in good health and longevity. I mean, the world has changed, but so have the solutions Pro offered to solve them. I mean, the world continues to change, and it's going to change in the future, but the financial world is changing along with it. And what we try to do here on the program is expose you, our listener, to many of the options available to you to solve a particular financial problem. Everybody's a little different, but we have a lot of common issues that we have to deal with. We all have to deal with longevity in retirement. We all are having to deal with sweeping changes the government is making to Medicare. Maybe you're fortunate enough to be in an income group where you've seen your Medicare premiums go up. You've seen that the government is covering less, so your Medigap premiums are going up. Or you have a health issue, and we all are living in a world today where interest rates and finding income returns are getting harder and harder to find. It's been that way for 7 years. It's likely to remain that way for the balance of this decade.
Well, you know, when I jump into something, especially if it's a field you don't know, I always say jump and then do something, because you can have a, what I call a bleh response. It seems so complicated.
Do that again.
Bleh.
Okay.
It's true. You look at it.
One.
You know, you look at it and go, huh, where do I start? And you don't know where to start. And I always say push something, you know, just push it in one direction or another. And so where do you jump in on this? Because if you begin to break it down into step one, you do this, step two, you do that, that makes it a little less daunting, shall we say.
I mean, it begins, as it always does, just like your New Year's resolution, by setting a goal and then taking steps and putting them into motion. Let's say formulating a plan to achieve those goals. For couples, it really takes a commitment. And we have found just over the years, you know, the more that both spouses are committed to the plan, not just one spouse, the better the plan turns out to be, because both participate. And, you know, even between spouses, there may be a wide variance in terms of objectives, goals, risk tolerances. And especially for a lot of you women that are listening to this program, because you're more likely to be the survivor. Statistically, you live longer than a man. And so Social Security benefits, investment strategies are much, much different. And you'll see that in one of the case studies that we're going to discuss today. The good news is that this is still the beginning of the year, so there's still plenty of time to put a plan into effect and see the results.
Now, Jim, you've been doing financial planning for 35 years. And one of the things that is always important is you learn from the mistakes of people who have gone before. You don't have to repeat them just because you're here. And so avoiding the rocks or telling people where the rocks are is a good part of navigation. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you have seen people make over the years? And maybe conversely to that, then, let's look at some of the greatest rewards as a result of the planning.
I would say probably the biggest mistake is the obvious one, which is what we're talking about today, is having no plan and sort of winging it. You know, a lot of times for many individuals as a result of the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, a lot of people were laid off from work. They might have had a plan to work to full retirement age, and all of a sudden that plan came to abrupt halt during the financial crisis and the recession. So not having a plan, I think, is one way, because it can lead to all kinds of mistakes and disasters down the road. The other two areas I see are in the area of taxes and investments. Investments, you know, probably in the past was not as great a problem as it is today. I mean, basically in the 90s, I mean, you made money if you were at the bank, if you were in bonds, or you made a lot of money if you were in the stock market. So maybe a mistake might have been, maybe you weren't in the stock market, so you didn't get some of those gains. But since the financial crisis, since 2008 and 2009, John, this has become a much, much bigger problem. I see individuals are, you know, abandoning sound investment principles like diversification. We see that a lot. Or panicking during market bottoms and getting out. And then, you know, once you get out, they stay out. It's very hard to get back in. And this proclivity that we see today to fall victim to what I call the gloom and doom crowd, peddling doom, Armageddon. And the other thing we see, over-investing in one asset class, whether it's all in bond funds or it's gold and silver. I mean, bond fund investors have fared much better, but they missed out on a 250% return in this bull market that began in March of 2009. I mean, you made money, but you didn't make as much. The gold and silver investors have experienced losses, and especially since 2011, that have been great, if not greater, depending if they own gold stocks, than the financial crisis in 2008 and 9. And the other mistake I would say we see a lot is on the tax front, where individuals or their heirs pay unnecessary estate, income, or capital gains taxes. But I would say three areas, John. Not having a plan and just sort of winging it. Number two, in the area of investments, we see that putting all their eggs in one basket, or failing to diversify, or panicking and letting their emotions direct their investment decisions. And then finally, I would say is probably the tax issue.
Well, what about some positive results too?
I think probably on the positive side is a client of mine. We began with the grandfather who became a client of mine back in the early 80s. He referred me to his son who was a physician. We not only did a plan for the grandfather, we did a plan for the son, and now we've done plans for his daughters and his son. So, John, we're talking about three complete generations of planning, and we're dealing with what will be a substantial legacy by the time we get to the fourth generation. It's already incredible wealth when I consider where dad is today. Grandfather passed on, but dad has built a substantial nest egg for himself, and that continues to grow. And his children are successful. He's got them with plans. One of them is doing very, very well. He's a petroleum engineer, and he's working overseas, so he gets a tax break where he doesn't pay taxes on like $96,000 of his income. He's just salting that away. The oil company is picking up his expenses. You know, he's not quite at $1 million, but, you know, by the time he gets into his early 40s, he's going to be a millionaire, and not to mention the fact of what he's going to inherit. So it's really kind of fun to see this over three generations and the impact of this over a period of time.
Okay, as we round out the conversation here then, what steps should clients take if they really want to see substantial financial changes in this coming year in 2016?
You really should discuss it between yourselves and reach a goal and a commitment, and both of you agree on it. And the next step is really to determine if you have the expertise to do it. Some people do. You're going to do it yourself, or maybe you have somebody in the family, a child or relative or somebody that's in the business, or choose to work with a professional. And if working with a professional, make sure you know their background, the way in which that individual is compensated, and most important, an individual you can both relate to.
Don't forget, just coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll have Wade Fow on the program discussing the major changes in Social Securities and strategies which still apply. But first, we need to do our case study on the program. All of our case studies are real-life case studies. We change the names to protect the privacy of the individuals involved. So, what are we doing today?
This is the case of Dr. Bob Nelson. We'll just call Bob to make it easier. And John, talk about major changes hitting you in retirement. In 1 year, he got a divorce. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and he retired in December of last year. So all three of those things hit him in a single year. So obviously, his view on retirement has changed since he was originally planning to be married in retirement. In response to the divorce, he's had to readjust what was important to him and what would retirement look like as a single. And given these changes in the divorce settlement, his former wife got the house, and he has decided not to buy a home. And there are a couple of reasons on discussing that, because right now he's been diagnosed with the early stages of Parkinson's, so he's still able to travel. He retired at age 70, and while he is able to, he wants to travel as much as he can. He doesn't want to spend a lot of money because, number one, he's obviously going through a divorce. He doesn't have as much of assets as he would had he remained married. And number two, he knows longer term with Parkinson's, he's going to end up in a long-term care facility. So it didn't make a lot of sense to expend a lot of money on putting money into a house. And we spent a lot of time discussing the housing issue and the long-term care issue because, it being a physician himself, he's aware of what happens eventually with Parkinson's. Now, they've come up with some wonder drugs that can help delay and arrest the deterioration of the process, but he knows further on down the road, those are issues he's going to be facing when it comes to health care. So what we're going to have to do is dedicate more funds at the beginning of his retirement, because that's where he wants to do his travel, why he's able to do it and get around. So he's taken a big, big trip to Asia this year, which includes New Zealand, Australia, and China for almost 30 days. So that's something that's always been on his bucket list. He wants to get that. And it's during retirement, it's really important to him to be able to maintain. He wants to maintain the same lifestyle without making any sacrifices or lowering his living expenses. And in his case, even despite his diagnosis of Parkinson's, his family has a history of longevity, with his grandparents and parents living into their 90s as well. So he doesn't want to be a burden to his kids. He would like to maintain freedom. So we wanted to look at a couple different options, from assisted living. Quite honestly, with the diagnosis of Parkinson's and being age 70, he doesn't qualify for long-term care due to the diagnosis. So we had to think outside the box. So the challenges in this financial plan are funding the needs for long-term care and longevity, given the medical history of the family, with both parents living well into their 90s. His liquid and total net worth is roughly about close to $3 million. It was $2.7 million. And refining basically retirement as a single individual, becoming divorced, and at the same time being diagnosed with a serious disease, and maintaining living expenses through retirement as he had while he was working. One of his things he loves to do, he loves gourmet cooking, he loves fine wine. By the way, he's made some great wine recommendations. So imagine that. Imagine that you had a plan, you're looking forward towards retirement, and just as you get closer towards retirement, you're hit with two things: a divorce and being diagnosed with Parkinson's. Quite a heavy load to start out your retirement.
All right, so you frame the issue here. Now, obviously, since he has a medical issue already, which is probably going to require long-term care, probably didn't make too much sense buying a house. And what about managing the rest of his assets as well?
Well, we did a number of things. Number one, he retired at age 70, and we delayed his required minimum distribution from his pension plan until this year to avoid the higher tax bracket, since he was working throughout all of 2015. That was one thing we did. We handled the issue of basically not spending a lot of money investing in a home, because eventually he would like to be in some kind of retirement home kind of facility where he could get assisted care. And besides that, even if he was to buy a house, it would probably be something like a single-story condominium, something inexpensive where not a lot of money was expended, because eventually he'd like to sell it. And then the other thing is, while he is able to, health-wise, he wants to spend a lot of time traveling. So the first thing we did from tax planning is we suspended his required distribution at age 70 from his retirement plan, which you can do. You can move it over into the next year. So we moved it over into 2016. We changed his investment portfolio more towards an income orientation, especially getting him out of maybe some of the more growth-oriented aspects of his portfolio. In other words, reducing some of the risk and increasing some of the income. And we did that with the laddered bond portfolio. The other thing we did is we took $500,000 and invested it in a purchase index annuity to cover assisted living expenses. It's a annuity that will build up and will have special provisions should he go into a long-term care facility, because here, given his age and also given his disease, he would not qualify for long-term care. We updated his estate plan. The divorce ended amicably. His former wife is the beneficiary on his pension plan and his estate. And likewise, with his wife's estate, he's the beneficiary. So it was an amicable divorce. Also, he had a large position in precious metals that we reduced and used some of the losses that he had in precious metals to offset some of the gains in repositioning his assets, because he had quite a bit of money in precious metals, way more than he should, especially heading into retirement. And now he's in a different situation because he's basically living on half the assets he would have had he had, let's say, lived in his paid-for home and having twice the amount of assets, because the assets were split as a result of the divorce. But that was basically a plan. But talk about a situation that hits you when you retire, is not only deciding to end a long marriage, which is a very difficult decision, especially given the age, and then secondly, being diagnosed with Parkinson's. And so this was kind of what we decided to do. It just didn't make a lot of sense with less income to live on, and especially in this low interest rate environment, and especially since we were going to have to take a large chunk of the assets, put them in a special kind of investment vehicle that essentially was going to be a self-funded vehicle for a long-term care facility when it arrived at that point, which also made a lot of sense too, of not only taking money to put it in this special annuity, but also not to spend a lot of money investing in a home, because he could rent and live comfortably. And when considering that he's going to be spending and doing a lot of time traveling, in fact, that's where he is right now. He's overseas enjoying something that was on his bucket list. He always wanted to visit China, Australia, New Zealand, and see that part of the world. And he's going to be there for the entire month of January.
Right. And that one sounded a little more complicated than normal there. You were working with multiple factors already running, not just planning something that might happen, but rather planning something that was fundamentally underway. Coming up next, Wade Fow is our guest today. Major rule changes in Social Security. What strategies and tactics still apply, even despite the change in rules? All of that as lifetime income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, last year, unbeknownst to many people, Congress made major changes to Social Security. They may change the amount of benefits that you get over your lifetime. What does all this mean for your retirement? Joining me on the program is Professor Wade Fow from American College. And Professor, let's begin with some of the changes, because, I mean, those were some pretty big changes, and there wasn't a lot of discussion about it before those changes were made.
Right. Yeah. Late last year, the Congress enacted some new proposals regarding some provisions that were created in the year 2000 that allowed for filing and suspending and different things. This will affect a limited number of people, but it became a really popular strategy to discuss in the popular culture. And last year, Larry Kotlikoff had, I think, the number 3 best-selling book on all of Amazon about Social Security claiming strategies. And he basically began the first chapter of his book with the strategy that's now being phased out. And that's some people who are going to use it and would have high Social Security benefits could potentially get up to around $50,000 of additional benefits that they'll no longer be able to receive. The idea was the higher-earning spouse would file for their Social Security benefit at their full retirement age and suspend receiving it until age 70 so that they get those additional credits for delaying Social Security. But at the same time, their spouse could file a restricted application and receive 4 years of the spousal benefit while their spouse's benefit had been suspended. And that's not going to be possible anymore for people. There's a few different things going on, I think, for the most part, for people reaching the full retirement age after May 1st, 2016.
Yeah, and we might want to point out those strategies are still available. I think, isn't it, doctor, if you are 65 and a half or 66 right now?
Right, so they're still available right now. You have to reach 66 by, I think, May 1st of this year.
Now, when Social Security benefits were put into place and some of the modifications, you know, there has always been this debate, should I take it at age 62 when you can first get it, or delay the benefits to age 70? Now, it used to be a much easier call to make. Number one, when Social Security was first put into effect, people didn't live as long. And certainly, if you look at over the last half century, interest rates were much higher than where they are today. So in those days, you know, it was pretty clear if you delayed claiming, if it was possible, especially for singles or, let's say, a higher earning spouse, in many cases, the husband, it made a lot of sense. Let's talk about now that we no longer have file and suspend and file and restrict, what about the benefits of delaying Social Security? Because we know that, for example, after full retirement age of 66 or 67, if you delay until age 70, those benefits go up 8% a year. Who does that strategy benefit today? In other words, where would that strategy be appropriate?
Well, that strategy is something that continues to get better with each passing year. Now, one of the extra icings on the cake for doing that is now being phased out, but it doesn't overturn the general idea of delaying Social Security. The 8% credit increase as you delay towards 70, that was developed in 1983. Interest rates were a lot higher at the time. People were not living as long, and that was meant to be, quote-unquote, actuarially fair, that it really shouldn't matter what age you claim Social Security. If you delay, you would miss out on the benefits for the years you're delaying, but then you get a higher benefit subsequently to offset that, so that if you live to your life expectancy, you should just break even. But since 1983, as people are living longer and as interest rates have come down, I mean, the Social Security actuaries used a 2.9% real return assumption. And now today, if you look at TIPS, that's where you see the real interest rates. They're much lower. They're even under 1%. So you're basically, by delaying Social Security, you're getting a much higher real return on a quote-unquote asset of your future Social Security benefits than if you were to claim early. So the case for delaying Social Security really has become stronger because it's more thinking about Social Security as insurance. It's longevity protection. It protects against market risk. It's an inflation-adjusted benefit, and it lasts for as long as someone lives. And you do better if you make it past approximately age 80. But I always say, you know, the concern is, what if you don't live to age 80? What if you delay Social Security to 70 and then die at 75? Well, of course, in hindsight, it would have been better to claim earlier. But at the same time, because you unfortunately didn't live as long, your retirement was not as expensive. It's unfortunate, and you could have been better by claiming earlier. But the concern that people should really have is, what if I live to 100? How can I afford that? And that's where you can improve your lifetime standard of living significantly by delaying Social Security. And I really think that's where the focus should be, on protecting oneself over a long lifetime rather than planning for a short retirement that's not going to be very expensive anyway.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me, too, we know, for example, if, let's say, full retirement age is 66, and you delay taking those benefits to age 70, the government is going to increase that benefit at 8% a year. Professor, I don't know any place in the marketplace today where I could get a guaranteed 8% return a year or increase for at least a four-year period. I couldn't even get that in a small, let's say, intermediate bond.
Right. And it is important to make clear, because this can be a confusing issue for people, that you're not really getting an 8% return. It's just that your benefits increased by 8% for each year of delay. To know what the return you get on delaying Social Security requires knowing your age of death, because it requires calculating an internal rate of return where the payment you're making is the lost benefits for each year that you delay. And then the benefit of doing that is then the subsequent increase in benefits after that later year where you start your benefits. And can get up to close to 8% if you live, it depends on a few assumptions, but if you live somewhere in the ballpark of 95 to 100, you could be looking at an 8% real return on the internal rate of return on delaying your Social Security. If you don't live that long, the internal rate of return is less. But nonetheless, it's definitely important to think about, and it is important to be clear that it's not that you're getting an 8% return automatically by delaying Social Security, because this issue, it depends on how long you live.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, obviously, if you don't live to, I think, what did you say, the break-even is around age 80?
Yeah, in the early 80s, somewhere around. It depends on what discount rate you use as well, but with interest rates, real interest rates being so close to zero, if you assume zero, basically the break-even age is age 80.
Now, you've given an example of a couple that could claim Social Security benefits at age 62. The benefit would be roughly $2,500 a month. Since they're taking it at age 62, that would be reduced by 25% or $1,875, versus allowing that benefit to go to age 70, which that monthly benefit would grow to almost $800 a month more. You've given an example of a drawdown from a portfolio in the early years and then less of a drawdown in the later years because the benefit is made up primarily from an increase in Social Security benefits. Let's talk about that, because the withdrawal rate actually declines. And isn't that one of the real risks that retirees are running today? Because there's two influences that have come in here that have altered retirement income. One, we're living in a period of unusually low interest rates. We've never seen something like this in half a century. And number two, people are living much longer.
Yeah. And so delaying Social Security is giving you, it depends how long you live, but if you make it to life expectancy, it's giving you a 2.9% real return. And that's really attractive compared to other alternatives. And so that's where, if you set up a problem where if you're 62 years old and you delay to 70, you do have the issue that for that eight-year period, you're going to have to take more out of your portfolio. And if you just leave that all in a volatile investment portfolio, you are more exposed to sequence of returns risk. But I created some examples that just assume you carve out those 8 years of missing age 62 benefits from your overall portfolio and set that aside and not really expose it to market volatility. Just do something much safer, either some sort of CD ladder or a fixed-term annuity or an eight-year bond ladder, something that's not going to be exposed to volatility. And then just set that aside, and now you have whatever's left in your portfolio. Well, you can then basically glide through lifetime, considering at age 70, you now get a much higher, 76% higher Social Security benefit. That will reduce the overall withdrawal rate you have to use on your investment portfolio throughout your retirement, which this is meeting a particular spending goal. So if you're able to meet your spending goal with a smaller withdrawal rate, you're improving the chance for your retirement success. And again, that's possible just because Social Security delay provides such a high, safe internal rate of return.
Professor, who would this apply to? I can think of several cases. For example, a lot of executives or individuals that work for corporations, many of them, especially I've seen this in the oil industry, the big oil companies, they'll have something like a deferred comp program for their executives. And so that deferred comp is paid out over a 10-year period, 5-year period. It seems like delaying Social Security benefits is an ideal strategy for those kind of individuals. And another area that I've seen work out real well is where an individual will take a certain amount of their portfolio and create their own private pension by, let's say, an immediate annuity. I know you've done a number of studies on bond portfolios, stock portfolios in terms of drawdowns over life expectancies, and you have found the combination of annuities and, let's say, dividend paying stocks or dividend paying mutual funds to be a worthwhile strategy that plays out well over the long term.
That's right. Yeah, the income annuities basically can serve as somewhat of a replacement for the bond funds because they're providing bond-like returns and also provide that longevity protection that the bond fund is not able to provide. And that being said, Social Security is an income annuity, and in particular, it's a CPI-adjusted income annuity. And really, the first step of moving in the direction of purchasing an income annuity, it would be pretty inefficient to start Social Security at age 62 and then to buy an income annuity. That basically the best deal you can get on income annuities is to delay Social Security. You get a much higher implied payout rate from doing that, where you think of the premium for the annuity is your 8 years of lost benefits, and then the payout from the annuity is that 76% increase in benefits starting at age 70. The implied payout rate from doing that, it's better than any commercial annuity. But they both tie in very well together, that I do think income annuities can play a very valuable role in a retirement income plan. And basically, Social Security is the best example of an income annuity, better than any commercially available version.
You know, Professor, at one time, companies, many corporations in this country offered what was called a defined benefit pension plan, which the government still does. And what they didn't realize is those defined benefit pension plans were really income annuities. The company would go to some insurance company and they say, you know, Joe worked at the company for 30 years. This is a pile of money that we put aside for him. What kind of income will that provide for Joe and his wife, or just Joe alone, depending on what his options were? That's basically what defined benefit plans are, the way they used to work. When you are taking an immediate annuity, you're almost doing the same thing. And the reason I want to bring this up is for the longest period of time, when returns were much higher, let's say in the stock market, because valuations were lower, interest rates were much higher than where they are today, the standard strategy for many individuals is when they retired, they rolled over their 401k program into, let's say, an IRA rollover, and whatever they would earn, they would take a withdrawal. And today, some of those companies offer annuity options that are actually much better. The reason I bring this up is we're working on a case right now where the annuity options for this couple, for this individual that worked for this company, are much more attractive than what we could get in the marketplace, let's say trying to get income from bonds or even where the stock market is.
Right. I've seen a lot of examples of that as well, where the defined benefit pension, someone's looking at the alternative between taking a lump sum or receiving an income for life. And if you look at the income for life and you look at the lump sum payment, it implies payout rates that, again, often do exceed the payout rates. You'd be much better off taking the lifetime income from the pension than you would be by taking the lump sum and then using that to go buy an annuity. And so, yeah, it can be a very attractive type of proposition. The defined benefit pensions are essentially income annuities. The reason we've had trouble with them is not anything to do with their guaranteed income side. It's just been this tendency that people ignore what the actuaries are saying. And it, no matter whether it's the government or a private business, the current leadership is always more willing to increase the benefits in an unsustainable way because they know those promises are only going to be paid well off into the future when the current management has already retired or is otherwise no longer working, or it's a politician making the decision who will no longer be around at the time the bills come due. So the defined benefit pension pools longevity risk among all the workers, and it pools market risk by providing a defined benefit amount based on years of service and salary, not based on any sort of investment growth for an underlying individual account. And so workers could benefit from that. They didn't have to bear that market risk on their own, and they don't have to bear the longevity risk. They're pooling that with all their fellow workers from different birth cohorts and from within the same retirement cohort.
Why do you think annuities have gotten such a bad rap? I mean, there's even commercials on television warning people about annuities that they're bad investments, where basically, as we just described here, most people that are getting a steady pension, whether it's a government pension or a corporate pension, essentially what they're getting is an annuity.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that basically the kinds of annuities I've been talking about thus far represent about 4% of the overall annuity market. Income annuities or immediate annuities are a very small piece of the overall market. There's much more complicated annuities, whether they're indexed or variable annuities, different types of annuities that they're much more complicated to understand. They have much higher commissions built in and so forth. And it's really those are the annuities that are creating the bad reputations, but they're 96% of the market. So they're the ones that kind of overwhelm the overall discussion. But also, I think it's the financial services industry is kind of divided between the investment side and the insurance side. The insurance side generally thinks everything can be solved with insurance, but the investment side generally thinks everything can be solved with investments. I don't know how many times I've seen like calculators on the market about how much you can save for retirement and so forth that just assume you're going to get an 8% compounded return. And markets are volatile, and I think on the investment side, sometimes there's not enough credit for what annuities can do just because there's this implicit assumption that you're always going to get. Well, if you're guaranteed to get yourself an 8% investment return on your portfolio, then yeah, you're going to be better off than with an annuity. But if markets don't cooperate, and when you're retired and you're exposed to that sequence risk where market returns early in retirement matter so much more, so disproportionately in what the overall outcome is going to be, then it's not clear you're going to get the kind of return necessary to beat out what an income annuity would be able to guarantee for you. So I think that's the other side of the puzzle as well. It's just that income annuities are a small part of the market, and then the investment side, and as well with a fee-only investment management firm, they don't make money by selling financial products like annuities. They make money by having as big of investment portfolios for their clients as possible. And so any money that leaves that portfolio and goes into an annuity, the investment management company can no longer bill for that. And so their financial incentive is to keep everything in the investment portfolio.
Let's talk about also some of the tax implications of delaying Social Security benefits, because a lot of times, you know, when a person leaves the workforce, they're going to be in a lower tax bracket. Number one, they're not paying Social Security taxes anymore. And some of the benefits of, let's say, using part of your portfolio, whether you create an immediate annuity or you're drawing it down and delaying the benefits, but there's some tax savings that are involved in here as well that might work to the advantage of a retired person.
Yeah, I think especially for the middle class, if you combine delaying Social Security with a program of Roth conversions, you can reduce your overall lifetime tax bill. Because as you're saying, and assuming you've retired, so that if you say retire at 62, so you no longer have labor income or earnings from the workforce, then that really changes your tax picture. Now your taxes are going to be paid on capital gains on your investments, on any distributions from your tax-deferred accounts and so forth. You don't have to pay taxes on anything taken out of the Roth. So you can have that opportunity to set up, move assets from your IRA into your Roth IRA, pay taxes between those ages of 62 and 70, when you may be, for a while, 0% tax rate, but then 10% tax rate, and then 15% tax rate. Manage those brackets. And it depends. It's where middle class folks might be able to manage that 15% tax bracket and better stay out of the 25% tax bracket. And that can provide a way to lower their overall lifetime taxes. Because you also have to remember that Social Security income is taxable, not in the same way as regular earnings, but there's a series of complicated steps. It's not just the adjusted gross income, but the adjusted gross income plus half of the Social Security benefit, plus any interest that was otherwise tax-free. And if that amount exceeds certain thresholds, then you have to start paying taxes on some of the Social Security benefits. And so doing those Roth conversions and delaying Social Security can also help set up opportunities to avoid having to pay taxes on Social Security benefits later on as well, because you can fill in any gaps in your spending needs from Roth distributions, and that does not show up on your tax form.
You know, you're a professor of retirement income. at the American College. What would you say are some of the more daunting tasks facing retirees today as you studied the subject?
I think it's always the question of how much can you sustainably spend? When should you start Social Security? And I know a lot of people do worry about whether the government's going to cut Social Security, and should you buy income annuities? How are you going to cover long-term care expenses? Do you have a plan for that, or do you have insurance for that? What to do about your home? Do you want to stay in the same home, or do you want to downsize? And if you do stay in the same home, then you can think about, should you have a reverse mortgage on your home, and all these other issues. There's a lot that goes into building a retirement plan, and to just manage the different risks as well, the market volatility, the longevity, not knowing how long to plan for, inflation. With inflation over time, you can't just have everything in cash, or the real value of your assets will decline, and so forth. It's a challenge, but it's something that can be managed and overcome, especially working with a financial advisor or spending a lot of time to study the issues on your own.
You listed a statistic. We've been talking about delaying Social Security benefits here. If you went back to 2008, only 5% of the public was doing that. As of 2014, 11%. So more and more of this information and the benefits are getting out. Do you find that as more people, let's say, do more planning for their retirement, that they're finding out these benefits? Because I read the statistic, and you probably are more familiar with that statistic than I am, of how many Americans actually have a retirement plan as they head into retirement.
Fewer and fewer people have the defined benefit retirement pensions anymore. But right, it's true that since around 2008, there has been an uptick in people who delay their benefits past the full retirement age. At the same time, there's been a big drop in the number of people who claim at age 62 as early as they can. That was over 50% for years and years, and then it started dropping, and it's now under 40%. So I don't know exactly why that happened. I like to think part of it is this growing recognition and more discussion, more education that people are getting about that it's not necessarily a good idea to just claim Social Security as soon as you can. That's probably part of the reason. I don't know if there's other factors at work as well, of people just being forced to delay their retirements and so forth. But there's definitely a trend. People are starting to claim Social Security later than they always were over the last 30 years prior to around the 2008 era.
Do you think that's maybe more confidence that Social Security will be there? Because I know for the longest period of time, it was claim it at age 62 because it might not be there.
Yeah, for a long time, people have worried about this issue. I don't know if people are becoming more confident that it's going to be there or not. There might be some Gallup polls or things on that. I remember in the late 90s walking around Washington, D.C. when I was there one summer, and there were people who had a display about how more Americans believed that aliens had visited the Earth than who believed that Social Security will be there when they retire. And yeah, those concerns are overblown. And I don't know the trend whether people have backed off of that and do start to recognize that Social Security will be there or not. Perhaps that education is getting out there as well.
Well, listen, Professor, as always, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. If our listeners would like to follow your work and your blog and the things you write about retirement, how can they do so, please?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I run the website retirementresearcher.com. It's all one word, retirementresearcher.com. And I blog and write frequently on different topics. I'm right now starting to write more about long-term care, and then after that, I'll probably have a series on reverse mortgages. So thanks a lot for that recognition.
Well, keep up the great work, and please come back and talk to us again.
Thanks. Yeah, I hope so. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Jim, I think one of the most important things that we could look at right now is the idea of getting in shape, and that there are actually ways to do this that aren't bad. And we're talking about, first of all, physical shape, because that affects your longevity, but also getting into shape financially. There's a series of things that people should do, and it needs to become part of your lifestyle. It's not something that is what I call a grunt thing that you have to do. I have to grunt and try to make this happen. It involves a gradual rework of your lifestyle, but it's really important. So we're going to make that the theme here on Lifetime Income this year.
Yeah, because, I mean, this is the time of the year where you make those New Year's resolutions. Okay, I'm going on a diet. I'm going to get to the gym, work off the extra pounds or the pounds gained over the holidays or whatever it is. But we always make those New Year's resolutions. And I think this is the year that I think financial resolutions should be made as well, because It's been proven over time, people that have a retirement plan have a much greater chance of having a nice retirement, not worrying about, let's say, outliving their assets than those that don't. It just makes sense. It's like going on a trip. You wouldn't go on a trip, a pilot wouldn't pilot a plane without GPS or a destination point. You need to do the same thing when it comes to your own retirement. So we'll be talking more about that in the weeks ahead. A lot of good programs coming up as we hit more issues on health and finances this year. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.